All right, welcome everyone to the Identity Implementers call for March 25th. Thank you all for joining. I'm sharing my screen right here, and that has the agenda for today's meeting. So feel free to check that out. Let me grab that link, and I will paste that in the chat here. All right, so on today's call, we'll go over some working group status updates and see what's happening in the community. We will also, I'll be giving the presentation today, and one of the things that has been concerning me is kind of a proliferation of languages, programming languages in the community. A number of years ago, when I was first introduced to SSI, one of the things that I thought was really intriguing was that a lot of the core libraries were mainly built in Rust. And then there were language-specific wrappers around that. And because of the difficulty involved, we've kind of moved away from that slightly. And so I found a way that I'd like to present to you all today that I think will make that easier and maybe make that more attractive to build a Rust library and then language wrappers for whatever platform you need to be on. So that'll be in the later part of the call there. Let's see, we're recording this call today, just so everyone's aware. Also, the Linux antitrust policy states that basically we are a community of collaborators, but we also have our day jobs, which require, you know, NDAs and proprietary information, things like that. We ask that you keep that info out of the call, but that you participate and share things that are of mutual interest so that we can all grow from that. And let's see. So I put the link in the chat to this wiki page. If you'd like to sign the attendees list, that helps us know who's attending. By way of announcements, coming up is the Internet Identity Workshop. Probably most of you know what that is and or have attended. That's one of my favorite conferences. It's the seminal conference for the identity community. Very interactive, a lot of good late-breaking material. It will be online this year, or this now in April again. They're not sure about the fall, from what I understand. I think the hope is for us to all get back together at the Computer History Museum in California, but go ahead and sign up for that. The other announcement is the Hyperledger Global Forum in June 8th through 10th, and there's a link for that as well. I guess I should have done this at the beginning. Are there any new people attending that would like to introduce themselves?
I haven't been on the call before, but I'm Michelle, and I'm a senior front-end engineer on the Kiva protocol team.
Excellent. Thank you for joining.
Thanks.
It's good to have you. All right. I'll go ahead and dig into, I think I know everyone else, so I'll go ahead and dig into the working group updates. I didn't see any reference to a main identity working group happening between March 3rd and now. The update that I had from March 3rd was that Drummond Reed gave a presentation of his new book that is releasing now, called Self-Sovereign Identity. I've read most of the book over at Manning. I don't get paid for this, so. I recommend it highly. It's very good. It's very comprehensive for a lot of things that are going on in our industry. So I put the link there. And like I say, that's not a paid endorsement. Did anyone happen to attend the Indie Contributors call today? Or this week, last one. Okay, I missed this last one. I put the link in the chat. They are, there's a big discussion going on right now for Indy, and the main effort is to update the Indy nodes to Ubuntu 20.04. So whatever Indy-based ledger you're running on, that's a concern for everyone. Currently, they're running on version 16, and that's being end-of-lifed. And so moving to version 20 is very important. There's a big discussion about what to do with the token capabilities. And so that's going on right there. I think what's happening is they've decided to update the token plugins and leave those in place. So those should be there. And then some other updates as well. But from what I understand, the developers on the upgrade path are making excellent progress on Ubuntu 20. We're coming down to the wire a little bit, but that should be here very shortly. Let's see. As always, there's a move to GitHub Actions. So the developers that are working that are making progress there as well. Let's see, did anyone attend either of the Aries working groups this week? Was there a working group in the morning? I didn't see any agenda for that. All right. So in the afternoon call, there were a couple of things that happened. There was a lot of progress. A lot of the outstanding PRs were approved and merged. And so I don't have a list of those, but there were several. I've put the link to the Aries working group page right there on the wiki page. So go ahead and take a look at those. Let's see. The big push right now is AIP Next. And so that's the next version of Aries interop protocol. And so that is nearing completion. I think any day now, we're going to see that done and wrapped up. And then that will be the current version. Before this call, a couple of us here were talking about what is it developers are supposed to implement? And so we're kind of in the little bit of limbo right now, where the current standard is the current standard for Aries. The current RFCs are what everybody's implementing. But as soon as this AIP 2.0 gets fully approved and solidified, that's where you'll want to be. And then there will be kind of a crossover period as people are moving from the earlier version to the current version. If I were starting a new project right now, I would start on 2.0. It'll take a while to implement those. And then you'll see the interoperability between agents start to improve as other providers update to the 2.0 standards. That's kind of where we are on that right now. But wherever I go into any of these working groups, interoperability is the name of the game right now. That's what everybody's working towards. And so it's a very much a common interest. And Aries is an excellent way to do that. Any questions on that? All right. Let's see. The Aries Bifold user group is up and running. I've provided some links there. Does anyone attend that? That's on this call. I've attended a couple of those. I think it's very interesting. Two thoughts. One is the code they're building is written in React Native. That's not something I I use necessarily, but the reason I attend is what they're doing is they're implementing a lot of these standards and RFCs that we're talking about. And so watching that progress, watching how that comes together is a really good learning experience for me. And so even though I don't work in React Native, watching how they build the library, how they structure things to create the bifold is pretty important. Let's see, some evolutionary updates on the libraries. So those are all in progress. Additional updates on the toolbox and testing. Let's see, Hyperledger Ursa. Some of the things that they're looking at, obviously, as a crypto library is post-quantum algorithms and how to integrate those into Aries and therefore into the rest of our toolkits. They're also looking for volunteers. And so crypto is one of those very specialized areas. If you have an interest and or expertise in that, Hyperledger Ursa is looking for developers and maintainers. Let's see, anyone happen to attend any of the Trust over IP meetings this week? All righty, let me give
you a link to those meetings. I tried to find that and I was dumb enough that I couldn't find it.
So I've put the link in the chat to this page that I'm showing you right now. And so I have links to those. I try to keep those updated every week.
Oh, great. Thanks.
So last week there was an all members meeting. And so I've got links there for the main wiki page for Trust over IP for the all members meetings, as well as the current weekly meeting. So March 17th was the most recent all member meeting. Now these are open to everybody. You can go and listen. And so they encourage that. I've also put slides for the meeting as well as the recording, so you can listen to that as well. They went over to the charter a bit, and then there was discussion of the Good Health Pass, and it's becoming a full Trust over IP project. And as a matter of fact, on the steering committee meetings that we had earlier this week, that was, I understand, unanimously voted to become a Trust over IP project effort. So things like governance and specifying interfaces and connections between Trust over IP layers and so forth, all of that will become part of the Trust over IP Foundation, which is pretty exciting. For those of you who aren't readily familiar with Good Health Pass, basically that's it's a global consortium, it's in response to the need to make medical health records interoperable between providers. It's seen a significant boost because of COVID-19 and the need to be able to prove that you recovered from the disease and therefore can't transmit it anymore, or that you got the vaccine and are immune to that. And so we're seeing health credentials in a variety of forms. I don't mind saying that I went and got the vaccine and they gave me a little card. No cryptographic anything on the card, not even a QR code. They literally just ink stamped the date of when I got the vaccine. And so that's considered my proof that I was vaccinated. Now that's not very secure. It's easy to spoof that. And so some of these organizations are getting together to make sure that there's a more of a verifiable, more of a trusted way of issuing those you were vaccinated credentials and then allowing people to express those. We're seeing airports and airlines and governments and border crossings all start to push for something that's verifiable. And so there's a lot of efforts And so what we're seeing here between the Good Health Pass and Trust Over IP is an attempt to make all of that interoperable or based on compatible standards. And so that's a very big effort. And that's been the topic at Trust Over IP for several meetings now, the main topic. Also in the steering committee, there was a presentation and discussion of ID 2020. And so they will be part of the Trust Over IP working groups now as well. Let's see, over the DIDCOM working group, they discussed a bunch of PRs and issues related to DIDCOM. I've put those in the chat here. I won't take the time to walk through them. But DIDCOM is one of those main interoperability vectors in our community. And so I would encourage you to either get involved in that working group over at DIF or to at least follow their proceedings, because things like the ARIES protocols and verifiable credentials and DIDCOM are kind of the mainstays of being interoperable between all of our various efforts. And to that end, the DIF interoperability group, I've put some notes on there from their meetings this week. Does anybody attend that one? That's one I have on my calendar and I keep meaning to attend, but other meetings conflict usually for me. All right, over at the Sovereign Foundation. So the Technical Governance Board has met and they are doing a couple of things, mainly housekeeping things right now. The big push is to get Indy updated to resolve the sovereign token, as I mentioned before, and get all of that updated so that we can all update our, you know, either the sovereign ledger or other Indy ledgers that we have implemented. Sovereign is looking for, they are reviewing all their security policies, their review documents, crisis management plans, so forth. So I put links to those. Feel free to review those as well. Sovereign's also looking for Chief Information Security Officer. So if that's something that you would like to do, please contact anyone over at Sovereign. I'm a member of the TGB, so you can talk to me if you'd like, and I can put you in touch with people you'd need to talk to for that. Other than that, there was kind of a discussion about all the various infrastructures. Obviously, as our part of the industry, we're moving away from Jenkins towards GitHub Actions. And so they're also taking stock of all the various tools and platforms that Sovereign uses. Let's see. Similar discussions have been taking place at the Sovereign Steward Council. And so they have, I believe they have an all steward meeting coming up next week, if I'm not mistaken. But I've put the presentation slides from the last meeting last week. And again, part of the big main topic right now is upgrading from Ubuntu 16.04 to 20.04. And I think everything's getting close. The token was a bit of a hurdle to get over. And I think we're about over that now. And then working on the CI/CD pipeline has been the other thing. So that's kind of an update. Any questions, comments, anything I missed that you'd like to bring up? All right then. So let me, I'm going to switch my screen and share my PowerPoint presentation here. Let's see. Can you all see that?
Yes.
Excellent. Thank you. Sometimes when I switch monitors on my local, it plays with Zoom a little bit and it doesn't get displayed. All right. So part of my motivation here, as I mentioned at the beginning of the call, and when I give presentations, I like to be interrupted. So if you have any questions, just interrupt me. Let's not wait till the end. But other than that, I'll kind of walk through what my thought process is here. So a lot of the SSI work had been done, very strong emphasis in using Rust as the main programming language for the lower. Yes, Jim, thank you. So using Rust for the main code body and then writing language specific wrappers for interoperating on other platforms and for building your applications. And the reason why that's good is Rust is very, very fast. It's on par with C language, but it also has quite a few protections for memory and ownership and access and error checking, and all the modern functionality is kind of boiled into Rust, but it's also very, very fast. And so that's very exciting. I'm hearing recently, reading articles and discussion threads about potentially using Rust for device drivers, maybe even inside for the Linux kernel and so forth. And so there's a lot of excitement about this. And so the fact that the SSI community started here was really kind of neat. Now there's a problem. And the problem is that writing wrapper code, I'll walk you through why this is hard to show you what the problem is. And, you know, aside from the fact that it's kind of hard to do, kind of tricky to do, it's also kind of the boring part of coding. And so a lot of developers, they want to build their favorite library. They want to build at the application level, make the two talk, but portability sometimes suffers because the glue code, the wrapper code that interfaces the applications to the libraries sometimes when they're in different languages is not anybody's favorite thing to do. And so I observed that a while back and started wondering, is there a solution to that problem? And so let me just kind of flip through some of these slides. So yeah, this is basically what I just said. You have your common library that you can build for whatever platform. So Swift is the iOS, macOS programming language. Python's everywhere. You know, there's Java. There's I guess I should have said Kotlin in this case. Anyway, we write all these wrappers so that we can take this common code and use it on whatever application or platform that we're working on. So let me walk through. I've got a simple example. I tried to boil this down to the absolute simplest I could to show you, kind of highlight what the problem is and then present a solution. And so here we have a very, very simple C program that's going to call into a Rust library. And so if I were to build, just like I postulated before, I build this big Rust library with all this neat functionality that I don't have to recode from platform to platform, and that's all well and good. When I go to implement it, I need to do a couple of things. So the first part here is I've got my string hello world, and I want to pass that into a library routine that I've called count bytes. And I want to get a value back telling me how many bytes are in that string. And so once I get that value back, I print it out, and that's the program. And so what I need to do is I need to have this function prototype up here that comes from, represents what's in the library that I'm linking in. And down below, this is a command line how I would build this particular application. And so looks very simple. I pass in a const care star string, and I get back an unsigned int 32, and very, very simple. So from the C language perspective at this point, things are good. So now as I build this library, building it in Rust, I create a cargo.toml file, and I specify, you know, all the typical stuff, the name of the package, the version, the authors, the Rust edition. That's why it says 2018 and not 2021. And then I specify my my library name. I'm just going to call it care count. And then the type of library that I'm creating. So I want to create a static library as well as a dynamic dylib for, I'm building this on Mac OS. So now when I go to build the library, this is what I've had to do. Because it's a Rust library, I need to expose an interface that they call the foreign function interface. And that's basically the way C calls things. And so I'm going to declare this function. Number one, I'm going to declare it public. Then I'm going to declare it as extern C so that it sets up the call interface that way. And then you see my function declaration there, count bytes. I also have to disable name mangling, which is, you know, to keep things compatible and interoperable. So now what I did, I started out, keep in mind that C program that I started with, very simple. I'm going to take a string pointer, I'm going to pass it in, count the bytes, get the value back. But when I get into Rust land, because of having to do, how pointers and memory are handled differently between Rust and C and what all that means, here are a few things that I have to do. So number one, this is kind of an unsafe operation. So in languages, modern languages like Rust and Swift, when you start messing with pointers like you would in C, that's considered an unsafe operation. And so we declare it as such here. The first thing I do is I'm going to create a C string. So this is a type of string that points to a C allocated memory. So that's what I'm passing in. I've got to get a handle to that I can use inside Rust. Declare it as unsafe. I'm going to check to make sure it's not null. And then I'm going to create a CSTR by calling the from pointer. And I'm going to pass in that C pointer that I passed in. So now I've got a C string. Well, in order to use the Rust routines, I have to go another step further. I have to convert it into a Rust string. And so I'm going to take the C string I created. I'm going to call the toSTR function and unwrap that. And what I end up with is a Rust string. So if you were to declare just a regular string inside your Rust application, this is now what you'd be looking at. And so with that, now I can start to call these Rust functions. So I'm going to take my Rust string right down here at the bottom. I'm going to count my character, or I'm going to get access to the characters and then do a count. And then as you're aware in Rust, the last line is the return statement. So I'm going to take that and then return it as an unsigned int 32. So this is fairly straightforward. As I walk through it, you can easily understand what's going on, even if you're not a Rust programmer. But there's a lot of steps here, and there's a lot of places to get things kind of mixed up or get them wrong. And so it's kind of a bit tedious. And so this function right here, if I were to break this out, like if I were building a bigger library with more than just one function, I'd probably break this out. And this stuff right here would be part of kind of an interface wrapper layer. And this last line that's doing the actual work, it might be in a non-public routine within the library. So what we see here, while this is very straightforward, it can also get very, very complicated as your library gets big. And, you know, if I build a library with, 50 public functions in it, and each of those has, you know, different combinations of strings and integers and structures and different things that I'm putting in, that's where it kind of gets really complicated. And if you look at some of the wrapper code that has been created for the Indie library and some of those others, you can see how complicated that gets. So even when I'm inside Rust, I want to create my unit tests. Even my unit tests get complicated by this. So I want to test that interface, even though now I'm strictly inside Rust running these unit tests. I have to go through basically everything I just talked about for calling this routine from C. I have to come in here and create a string, create it as a C string, get a raw pointer, pass in the raw pointer so that the routine can just go through all those steps that I just mentioned. And so this is very complicated. It's very tedious. This is not necessarily my favorite area to be coding in. And so I think that's kind of what's happened is, the complexity, the time involved in creating it, as well as, you know, probably some disinterest in doing all this work has led for us to kind of migrate away from some of this. And we're starting to see a lot of language and platform specific implementations of things. It would be really neat if, Aries code was fully implemented in Rust and we could just quickly build some language wrappers over that and then import it. That way we could all collaborate on building it together. We can test it once and have a common tested secure library that we could pass around, whether we're on iOS or working in Python on a web page or however we want to do that. That would be kind of a really good goal. So what's happened between traditionally what's been going on and what I'm seeing happening now is there is an effort over at Mozilla. It's under very active development. I'm pretty excited about it. And so I've put a figure in some things here, but the link that you'd want to look at is github.com/mozilla/ Unify-RS. I call it Unify. I don't know if they call it that, but it's uniting the foreign function interfaces across this. So what this really does is all of that stuff I just talked about, that wrapper interface layer that's tedious that nobody wants to write anymore, they have tools that will build that for you. And that's what seemed really neat to me. And I'll walk you through how those tools work. And so what we're seeing over here is you've got on this diagram, you've got your Rust business logic down at the bottom, whatever your library is intended to do. And then you've got all these different platforms up here where you want to port that to. So what the Unify tools do is they generate automatically what they call scaffolding layer. And so you recall in that Rust program where I received the C pointer and I had to create it as a C pointer and then convert it over to a Rust pointer. That's just a very simple example of what needs to be done to pass all this memory back and forth between the higher level language and Rust in the library level. And so that they call that the kind of scaffolding is what they call that. And they generate that for you. And then they also go another step and they create these language bindings so that you get a tighter integration with your target language. So one of the other drawbacks of doing foreign function interfaces the way we've typically done them is I work in Swift in iOS a lot, so let me talk from that perspective. That has a very specific way that programs are created. It has kind of a different architecture than C does when it comes to how you put things together. And so normally when we bring in these C foreign function interfaces, instead of Swift programmers thinking in terms of strings and objects and values and stuff like that when they call functions, they have to start thinking like a C programmer and think in terms of unsafe pointers and unsafe mutable pointers. And when you do that, when you interface to an underlying library that way, let's say you call in to the library and it's going, let's say it creates a string. So it reads it off the disk or something, creates a string and it returns that string. What's happened is now you, the programmer, the application programmer, have to be aware of memory management. You have to know that that was created using malloc or, whatever kind of, allocation method. And when you're done with it, you have to remember to free it or you get memory leaks. And so that's another problem where applications suffer from that. It causes security issues and whatnot, use after free errors and stuff like that. And so we would really like that to go away. And so Swift programmers on iOS don't really like talking to underlying C libraries because it's just hard. It's a different way of thinking. And so we'd like to get beyond that. So what the Unify does is it currently will generate all the scaffolding layer. It will generate language bindings. And currently it does that for Kotlin for Android and Swift for Mac or iOS. It does that for generates Python wrappers and then also C++ wrappers. And so you can look it up there. So how it works, I've tried to boil down the whole process. So as a developer, this is really what you do. So you'd create your custom Rust library. It would do whatever it is you do. And then you would expose some API functions as public top level functions. And then in the case of Mac, where I'm working, you would build a dylib, just like the simple example up above. Now, here's where there is a little bit that's different, and I'll show you what this means. You need to create what they call a UDL representation of all your API functions. And so that's similar to the interface definition language. It's a variation on that that is set up for this process. It's very simple. I'll show you what that looks like. Once you create that, then you can auto-generate this scaffolding layer that I talked about, and it makes all those foreign language bindings. It does all the FFI stuff at that point. I should clarify that on the slide. The fourth step is then you create the language-specific implementation. And the real benefit there is that even though it's an FFI calling a C library, for Swift programmers, it's going to make it feel like calling native Swift, which is really, really helpful. And then you can import that generated code and library into a native application. So let me show you how that works here. So let's say we create this Rust library. And in this case, I created something very, very simple, just a single function. And I wanted to take a Boolean value, so simple value, and basically increment it. So if I pass in a true, I want it to come back false. If I pass in a false, I want it to come back true. So here's my library that I've created there. And then this is what I did in my TOML file. So this is all the normal stuff that you'd create when building a Rust library. Dependencies, I created this and I built in Unify version 8. Some of the examples I was working with, one of the, this error crate, so I put a link for that as well. But then there's the library, I'm just calling it library. And then I wanted to create a CDylib. And so then I specified that as build dependencies as well. So that's all I had to do. So pretty much just kind of this line and this line are really all I had to add to my TOML file. And then this is just a top level function. All right, so this is what UDL looks like. So really what I'm doing is I'm creating a namespace with the name of the package I'm creating. So in this case, I just call it library, which, sorry if that's confusing. So I create a namespace for library. And then this function that I created right here that looks like this in Rust, that's what I put in here. So it's gonna return a Boolean. I'm just going to use snake case. So bool underscore ink underscore test is what I called it. I pass in a Boolean value. So that's all I had to do. That's not really too hard because as you're developing your Rust library, you know what all your public interface points are. And so the only minor complexity here is you have to enumerate those in a separate .udl file. And then it has to kind of conform to the UDL naming and format conventions. So a little tiny bit of work there, but not really much. So now the next step is to generate this scaffolding layer. And so what that is, this is a command line. It's called unifiedef-bingen. I'm telling it that I want to create scaffolding for that UDL file I just created. And so it'll go do whatever it needs. And that's a lot of code. That just even for this single function, it's going to be, let's see, how is it? If you care, I can show you. but it's a lot of code. Probably a couple hundred lines of code. And it handles all the things such as all these memory allocations and freeze and translations between what the upper calling program likes and what the Rust library needs. And so this does all of that. It's just boom, it's created. Now comes the language wrapper. And so this is one more step also done at the command line. So in this case, unify-bingen generate, and then I specify that UDL file we just looked at. And then I give it a command line parameter --language-swift. And then it will generate the library.swift that I've got right here. So this is this file is also a bit longer. It's about 500 lines of code. It does a lot of stuff as far as the FFI translations and managing things between memory models and so forth. But this is what that function looks like. So a couple of things happen. In Rust and also in the UDL, I used snake case for the function declaration. Knowing that Swift uses the camel case, it switched that around for me, put everything in the right order. And so this is now a routine that I can just import into my Swift application when I link to the library. And so this now, to me as a Swift programmer, feels like a Swift function. At this point, I really don't know or care that the underlying library was written in Rust. I just accept the convenience. Now, this application, I also redid it to create a test application for Python. And so the only difference, everything I've just said this whole walkthrough is identical for whether it's Swift or Python, except for this thing right here. So I will need to call this function again or invoke this command line tool again. To create the language bindings for Python, and that's it. And so then, let's see, oh, sorry. I was trying to see what this slide did different from the last one. This is what it looks like in Python. And so this is what's generated for you. It puts it in, you know, snake case format for Python and sets everything up. And so from Python, you can just call that function, and it's really kind of convenient. On the Mac OS side, for how you would implement that, this is just, again, this is a teeny tiny application just to show how you do it. So a couple of things I've had to do to import that dylib. One, I had to specify the dylib on my link in the library list. I had to take that library.swift that was generated, and I included that. And then the way Swift works with other models is you have to create what they call a bridging header. So I had to bring that in as well. So I included those three things, and then it's just available for me to use. So this right here, what you're seeing is really my entire application to create a macOS app in Xcode. And so a couple of print statements tell me what's going on. I pass in a value, I get a value back, and then I check it, and that's it. So for Python, it's the same thing. I just import the library, I take a value. This is doing some printout formatting, but basically the bulk of the work is done right here where I say library.bool ink test, pass in the value, get the value back, and it prints it out for me. If you reflect back on everything we've had to do for building Rust interface layers and wrappers in the past, which is a lot of work, this is really all I have to do that same thing using Mozilla's new tool. Now, built-in types, this is what the Unify tool accepts. It's Booleans, which I just, for this example, I just limited to that, but I've used all of these in other applications. And you can use unsigned ints, 8 through 64, as well as signed. You can use floats, double strings. You can pass strings and structures in by reference. There's hash maps and vectors and all these kinds of things that we normally use, as well as getting custom error types. We can use those as well. And so depending on the needs of your application and underlying library, all this is available, and those get auto-generated. Here's a sample of an expanded UDL file that I created just for the purpose of testing out each and every one of those types that were on the last slide. And so what I've done is I created a custom error type. I created a dictionary type point. So it's just you pass in an X, Y, and it does stuff with it and then gives you a result back. And so this is what the UDL looks like for all of those routines. And so very, very simple to understand. And so that's kind of where we are. So all of those kinds of routines, this even will test throwing errors and stuff. So I can see how an error thrown inside a Rust library might be handled by Swift or Python. And so let's see, I think, yeah, that's where we're at. I think as I look at this and the level of effort required for previous, wrapper Rust library interfaces, there was a lot of work there. And so what I had to do here was very, very simple by comparison. And that's not just because I had one function in my library for this demonstration, but just because the process, a lot of that code required for memory management and translation between layers is kind of automated for you by the tool. And so anyway, that is what I wanted to present today. Any questions on that?
Thank you, Steve. That was very interesting.
I'm glad you enjoyed it. I, I'll make these slides available. I'll post them on the wiki page so you can take a look at it. I recommend everybody kind of look into this, because if we can, you know, get back to the goal of write once, run anywhere kind of thing, and make that work in practice, I think there's a lot of value. And I think this tool, while very new, is also very helpful. So anyway, thank you for listening to my presentation today. I've enjoyed giving it. Hopefully it's helpful. And I'll put those links on the wiki page so you can pick those up, but it's unify-rs on Mozilla's GitHub page is where you want to look. Anyway, thank you very much for joining today, and we will meet again in 2 weeks' time.